The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Wigginson. Broadcasting from seven continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Wigginson.
Good afternoon, listeners. Welcome to the Sunday afternoon space show. It's afternoon here in California. Welcome to the program. I'm your host, David Livingston, and another good commercial space, space valuation program, which we all find awfully interesting, and that's why we like to discuss this topic. First, a couple of quick announcements. We're looking at probable, but not definite, 60-minute format today, so do pay attention to the time if you want to call us and get an email in as well. Remember, if you do come in at the 11th hour, we don't cut you off. We will continue until everybody is satisfied. So just to refresh your memory, the toll-free number is 866-687-7223 and email drspace@thespaceshow.com. I also have two other things to remind you about. October 6th, which is Tuesday, Mars will be the closest to Earth that it's going to be for 15 years. It's going to be 38.57 million miles away, just a hop and a skip. And it's very, very bright and red in the sky. And if you have clear skies, you can easily see it without any aids to your vision at all, unless maybe you wear glasses. It's worth going out and looking at it, even if that means going out late at night so it can get higher in the sky for you to see. But October 6th is that close date, 38.57 million miles away. We also have added a program to the schedule for Monday, tomorrow, 7 p.m., and this was requested by Dr. Zubrin when he was on the show for Jim Burke to come on and explain the Mars Society's very different virtual software and tools that they're using for their conference, which has close to 5,000 people enrolled in it already or signed up for it. But they've got real-time speakers from all over the world, regardless of the time, where you can interact with the speaker just like you could if you were in the room with them. So these are not pre-recorded talks or anything like that. Everything is real-time. And they've got very special software to allow them to do that. So I thought that that was noteworthy, and we're going to talk to Mr. Burke about that. So that's a special show Monday at 7 p.m., and then our regular Tuesday program. And go out and look at Mars, especially Tuesday night if you have clear skies. Our toll-free number, again, is 866-687-7223. And I know there's no call screener, so be patient, let it ring, we'll answer and get you up on air as quickly as possible. And the email, drspace, D-R-S-P-A-C-E, at thespaceshow.com. As far as our website goes, thespaceshow.com, the newsletter for next week is already posted, and you'll see that in the upper right corner. Make sure you scroll down so you can see all the programs we're planning between now and the end of the year. And your guest suggestions are very, very welcome. Just if you can and you have email contact or other contact for the person you're suggesting, please include that. Remember, all of our programming is archived, so you can listen right off of our website or easily download shows. We also have a store where we are actually approaching gift-giving season. So for stocking stuffers or other ideas for your favorite space show listener, check out our store. You get to it by clicking on Pepper Listening to the Space Show pictures on our website, and she takes you into our Cafe Press store. So hopefully you find some items of interest. Upper left, there is a Support the Space Show. There's a Listen Live button. So this tells you how to listen to the live broadcast and also podcast. and also archives off of our website. And I'm happy to help you troubleshoot. If you need that help, email me, drspace@thespaceshow.com. And then do remember we are a listener-supported program, meaning your contributions enable the Space Show to keep bringing you great programs like we have been recently, and as well as the program you're going to hear today. So if you are a federal U.S. taxpayer, you get a tax deduction for your gift since we're a nonprofit 501c3. And if you are a California taxpayer, you also get a tax deduction. We're a public benefit corporation in California. The best way to support us is using PayPal, and there's a big PayPal link at the top of our homepage and other Space Show web pages. If you want to use a check, you can certainly do so. Make it payable to One Giant Leap Foundation, and it mails to Box 95, Tiburon, California, 94920. And listeners and supporters, just like you out there listening right now, do keep the Space Show going. Do help us get great guests, and we need lots more of you. So we thank you very much for your support, especially those of you that are supporting us during these really challenging and very weird times, which include economic times as well. We also have the sponsors, and those sponsors are Northrop Grumman, the Space Foundation, Astrox, AIAA, Celestis, the National Space Society, and the Space Plan. Check out their banner ads going across the homepage. If you're interested in being a sponsor, email me at onegiantleapfoundation.org, and I can provide you with all the details of Space Show sponsorship. Excuse me. For today, I'm happy to introduce to the Space Show Dr. Robert S. Wilson. Dr. Sam Wilson is how he goes by. He's a policy analyst at the Aerospace Corporation's Center for Space Policy and Strategy. He is responsible for leading work on international space, nuclear command, control, communications, and missile issues. And before he came to aerospace, he was a senior analyst at Defense Capabilities and Management Division of the GAO. His full bio is up on the website, and you can read it. We want to talk to him. We don't want to read about him. But his paper, The Value of Space, is at the Center for Space Policy and Strategy. I will link to it in the summary of the program. But it is also linked to when we had a previous guest on who was a co-author on this paper, Michael Gleason, a couple of months ago. But we're going to talk to Dr. Wilson. We understand he sees things maybe a little bit different than what we've discussed before. And it seems like the value of space is more controversial maybe than it should be, especially after we talked recently to Dr. Crane of the IDA, and they did a value of space report. And you know, everybody's got a different view of the value of space. Dr. Wilson, welcome to the Space Show. How are you?
David, thanks so much. It's a real pleasure to be here. I do just want to clarify, I'm not a doctor.
You should be. So,
I should be. But
thank you for the correction.
I'm not a doctor. I really appreciate being on the show. I'm a big fan of Dr. Space. Some of my colleagues have been on the show, so this is a real treat for me.
Yeah, Dr. Veda has been on almost since the Space Show started nearly 20 years ago. Why is it so? Well, I want you to tell us about the value of space, which is a May 2020 paper from the Center for Space Policy and Strategy. But it does seem like you know, there's a lot of different views and perspectives on the value of space. And when I did have the IDA guy on, it was a week ago, and they took after all the investment banks that were giving a trillion-dollar evaluations of space, and he told why they were cutting that way back and had a different perspective. Why does it seem like there's so little agreement on the value of space?
Yeah, in terms of a quantitative sense of the value of space, I thought the IDA report, the IDA report, was really sound. I think there's a lot of, I think when we're in the space community, we have the tendency of just kind of hyping each other up and saying, oh yes, space is so important. Space is growing at such high rate, and space is going to be, you know, this $1 trillion economy in 10 years. And I think that, I think the methodology for some of those calculations based on what we were including was flawed. And I think IDA did a pretty good job. I thought, you know, I haven't done a quantitative analysis on it. You know, our report is really look qualitatively at the value of space and really kind of thinking about what is the sort of quotidian use of space. How does space affect our normal daily lives in ways that we may not appreciate, rather than just sort of being a macro look at, you know, what is the economic gains that we get from space, or, you know, what is the private sector space economy? What does that look like? So ours is, you know, we try to pull in some findings from other reports. So I think we pull in the NIST report, finding for how much GPS is produced in the civilian and commercial, as produced for some civilian and commercial purposes, in terms of economic gains, but we don't do a quantitative look at what the space economy looks like.
If you're trying to evaluate the value to space in our daily lives, I guess depending on who you survey, who you talk, or who you measure, I guess the first step would have to be that in order for people to value space in our daily lives, they'd have to have some kind of an awareness that space was playing a contributing role to their daily life. And I wonder how widespread that knowledge or awareness is.
Yeah, you know, I found myself learning a lot during the course of this report. So, Mick, you had Michael Gleason on, who is also an author for this report, and you know, he had, you know, the two of us. Mick has so much experience, more experience than I do. But he, you know, even he was really surprised at some of the really cool ways that space was playing a role in different sectors. And the way we organize this report is thinking, okay, let's pick six or seven or eight sectors, like agriculture, commercial fishing, oceanography, energy, you know, power grid. When I say energy, I mean kind of power grid operation, national defense, emergency response, all these different applications that are on the ground, and let's think about how space enables those sectors. So, you know, the report is really meant to be writing about the value of space in non-space terms. How is space contributing to us on the ground in ways? And I mean, so one of the sections I wrote was agriculture and the ocean monitoring and the power grid sections, and I was really taken aback, and particularly in the commercial fishing section, of just how space capabilities have done so much for commercial fishing, and how in the future they're going to be doing even more. You know, I think that's a cool. There's a cool through line of thinking about, you know, as some of these new technologies mature, we're going to be even more reliant on space capability.
So I have a question about that, because before COVID, I would go to restaurants in San Francisco on Fisherman's Wharf, and walking around and seeing the seals and all the fishing boats and the tourist boats, it's kind of fun, even when I've been doing it for 30 years. But a lot of these fishing boats, you know, they're small. They, you know, I don't think you'd want to sleep on them. But they don't seem to be high-tech boats. I'm not inside. I didn't ask permission to go on board or do anything. But I look at the antennas on top, and they don't seem to be terribly high tech. They certainly don't look like a Navy or a Coast Guard ship, for example, with antennas here and there. To what degree does the average fisherman who's going out under the Golden Gate Bridge and probably doing this in Seattle and Boston and all sorts of other places and comes back with daily fish that get into the local fish markets all over California and maybe elsewhere, and maybe they get shipped off and they're frozen. Are these guys using high tech, or are they just fishing like they did 50 years ago with their family fishing boat?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a couple ways. I think there's kind of a spectrum of ways that fishermen can use satellite systems. I think there's two ways that even at a more basic level, all fishermen are using pretty universally, and that's using and that's for GPS if they're going somewhere where they don't know, and then using weather satellites for collecting information on the weather. And they may be doing, you know, in terms of the latter, unknowingly, right? But they certainly, if you're a fisherman, you really care about what the weather is, and so you're getting better information because of our, you know, polar satellite orbiting systems, our geostationary weather satellite systems. So if that information is getting, you know, fed into them for however they're collecting weather data. You know, they're probably going on the Weather Channel at a basic level and getting some information. And again, so there's going to be some information that even, you know, the most elementary fishermen are being used. But then there's at the high end, and so you're right, you know, at the low end, you're using, you know, just some basic capability. But at the high end, you can be getting these remote sensing satellite services designed for fishermen. You can be getting things like, you can get remote sensing data on sea surface height, on sea surface temperature. And the sea surface height is a really important one because it tells you where the currents are. And the currents are where the fish are. So you really want to get good information about sea surface height. And then also color is really important, which is also something you can tell from remote sensing satellites. So the color is a good indicator of where the fish are going to be because it's also an indicator of how healthy the oceans are, right? So, you know, a lot of these services for fishermen are also really valuable for ocean monitoring, for climate science, for oceanography. So you know, you have these sensors that are tracking this information on the top, and then they'll use things that they'll geo-reference. So they'll put buoys out that'll be collecting this information, or what are called sail drones, which are like sailboats but are drones, and they're collecting information also on the sea surface height, and that information will get geo-referenced. So a fisherman could get, you know, really good intel knowing where all these things are, where the currents are going to be based on the sea surface temperature, where it's colder, where the fish are going. So it's pretty unfair to the fish, David, because it's making it increasingly easy to be able to find schools.
Do fishermen pay for these services, or are they free like GPS?
No, these are pay for services. So Maxar is one of the providers that does this. I think Planet, because they have such a large constellation, is trying to do this. But yeah, and so you know, you could, if you have a big enough operation, you know, you might send out a bunch of buoys, or you might send out a bunch of buoys and lures in the middle of the Gulf. I spoke with a couple of fishermen in the Gulf who were working in the Gulf of Mexico. And, you know, they set out all these lures, which they all geo-reference using GPS, so they know where they are at the end of the day. But where they place them is based on this information they're getting from these satellite services that are designed for them. And, you know, for them, you know, it's not just remote sensing satellites that are really important, and, of course, GPS, just geo-referencing where these things are, but you know, they have specialized weather satellite services for them that they pay for, because it's really important to have good weather information when you're in the Gulf of Mexico, because the weather is so volatile. And then they also have, you know, they'll have satellite communications too. They'll have a sat phone, because they may not get good cell phone reception in the middle of the Gulf. So, you know, really between GPS, remote sensing satellites, weather satellites, satellite communications, they're using kind of every category of satellite system in their daily lives.
So these simple-looking fishing boats may, in the end, not be so simple, right?
Yeah, I mean, I would say the simple ones probably are not doing the full extent of what I'm talking about. I imagine they're probably, but I suspect they're still using, even if they're not thinking they're using satellites, they're still using probably GPS and weather satellite information.
So space is a huge deal in fishing and the food supply then.
Yes, absolutely. And not just in, you know, and when you're talking about the food supply, in agriculture as well. I was surprised. Obviously, you know, farmers have been tending crops for millennia, but the precision agriculture revolution, which has really been enabled by satellites, has really changed the industry. And I think, you know, partly you have remote sensing satellites that are able to track, track field, track the health of your crops and your fields. You have, you have harvest equipment that can track, you have combines that can geo-reference where you're getting good yield versus where you're getting bad yield. But the biggest difference is you have these tractors that you have this incredible precision with because of GPS. So you can now get jack tractors that can basically drive themselves with precision to centimeters, which is really important because then you're applying an effective and efficient level of fertilizer, right? Or you're tailoring your fertilizer, per yard, right? You're thinking about where now that I have all this information about my field, where are the places that need more fertilizer that I can use with my really sophisticated tractors that are using this heightened information from GPS. How can I make sure that I am applying the right fertilizer at the right places? So, agriculture was another area where I was really surprised, but it's been pretty fundamental. Satellites have been pretty fundamental to how that industry has changed.
Todd sent in an email from San Diego, one of our listeners, and he said if you put a mixture of commercial fishermen and farmers of all sizes of farms and fishing operations in a big room together, are they aware of the role that space is playing, and would they be supportive that it has really changed for the better their professions, or would they not be so aware that space is actually providing a lot of this information?
Yeah, well, it's a great question. I would say it's a slight mixed bag. I would say on the whole, probably the majority of fishermen and farmers are not going to appreciate how reliant they are on satellite systems. And I would say on the whole, they're not using satellite systems to their full extent possible, right? So I think most fishermen are probably not using the remote sensing. I think that's at the high end in terms of the remote sensing satellites that are tailored for fishermen for their capabilities. And most farmers are not yet using remote sensing satellites to the full extent possible. You know, remote sensing satellites now, you have hyperspectral sensors that can track chlorophyll levels, right? So these are really amazing things, but it's still kind of emerging and still becoming more important. But GPS for the tractors has become really universal. So they may not appreciate that GPS is what is the reason why they have these self-driving tractors, but GPS is. And similarly for fishermen, you know, they're really reliant on this, on really good weather information that we have. That's thanks in large part to the satellite. So they may not appreciate it, but they are using satellite information.
What about the consumers and the end users that go to the fish markets that buy products that the farmers make or go to farmers markets or you go to some of these farmer fairs in agricultural areas? Do the consumers have any real knowledge of how the farming and the fishing industries have changed and how they are benefiting from this technology? Or does it just not register with them? They just know that fishermen get fish and farmers grow artichokes.
Yeah, I'll speak for myself as a consumer of fish and someone who frequents farmers markets. I had no idea the extent, and I'm in the space industry, right? I had no idea the extent to which, until I started interviewing people and then pulling up some of the data that's available, I had no idea how important some of these capabilities were for commercial fishing and agriculture. Had some sense, of course, that, you know, fishermen are using weather satellites, because weather information is so important, and the weather information they're getting is from satellites, but to the full extent that you can see with some of these new capabilities, and the full extent of how farmers are using, and the full extent of how integral to farming these driverless tractors, these tractors that have this really enhanced precision because of GPS. I had no idea. So I think on the whole, consumers are unaware of how integral satellites are to the food that they buy at market.
Is changing that awareness with consumers a priority of industry or any group, or is it just simply not relevant to anything?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think I think a lot of the coverage for this, there's in trade magazines. You know, I think if you're looking at agronomy journals, there's a lot of focus about precision agriculture and how important satellites are to precision agriculture. And if you're looking at, you know, trade magazines for fishing, you're also going to see probably some focus on Maxar and these other technologies, these other satellite companies that are offering these tailored services. But I, you know, on the whole, I just don't think that conversation has made it to the broader public. And you know, that was kind of why we wanted to tell the story. You know, you started out with asking that question about Ida's estimates of what the space economy is versus others, versus some of the investment banks. You know, but it's hard to really get a grip of what that means. And, you know, for this project, we really just wanted to be able to kind of tell people, you know, how you go through your just day-to-day lives and how satellites are just so important. And just being able to showcase a few industries. I think we cover, you know, between 7 industries, just like, you know, you couldn't do all these things that you do without satellites based on how we do them. So you know, satellites have become, you know, really fundamental to a lot of the activities that we take for granted.
I have another listener question for you. So this is Larry. And Larry says, David, I'm in Northern California, as you are. I am astonished at the fact that the reporting on the fires is so oblivious to space resources being used in the fire prevention. About the only time I hear anything mentioned about space and the fire is if the space station shows pictures of the fire from the space station orbit. My understanding is the people actually dealing with the fires are very tuned in to space resources, but those of us listening to the news, no matter where we listen or what station or what media, we don't get any big connection to space. Would you ask your guest to comment on that?
Yeah, that's a really great question from Larry. It's a great point. The remote sensing satellites are really good at tracking these fires, and I would say even at a more basic level, we have some of our defense satellites that are focused, that the primary objective is missile warning, satellite capabilities like SBIRS and DSP, these DoD capabilities. They have infrared sensors so that if a missile launch were to go off, we'd be able to detect the heat from that boost. But that's also really good at seeing where fire starts, right? So if there was a lightning storm and it hit part of the forest, we would be able to these infrared sensors would be really good at being able to identify that. And of course, just overhead imagery is really good at being able to track these things. So satellites are really important. I mean, and I think also relevant today that's in the news, if you look, there's been a lot of reporting about how pollution in certain cities has gone down because of COVID, and you can see these satellite images that are actually really good at being able to show you which places have kind of stopped, their economic activity is kind of halted, versus others that have halted and then restarted or halted again. And that's because satellites are tracking the pollution in these areas. So, you have these capabilities that can track methane, that can track carbon dioxide emissions, and so that they're really being able to help tell the story of how this pandemic is playing out in different areas.
How do you value space? I mean, if it's qualitative, what are your economic parameters or financial parameters to say space is worth this, agriculture is worth this, people using remote sensing is worth this? How do you do that?
Yeah. So, our intent was to really try to tell the story surrounding these numbers that others are producing, right? So, we wanted to be able to kind of show how space is valuable for agriculture in a way that everybody can access, and not being quite so abstract in terms of are these satellite systems or is the space economy worth $180 billion versus $380 billion, right? That was part of our task. It was also trying to think about how reliant these sectors are on satellites. Obviously, satellites are integral to what they're doing, but if there was some sort of disruption, what would happen? What backups are available? What are other ways that these industries could flourish in the absence or disruption of satellite systems? And that's telling too to think about what sort of terrestrial backups we should be investing in. And I think there are obviously agriculture has and fishing, the two examples we talked about, have existed before satellite systems, and they would exist if satellite systems were disrupted. But just the application, these new technologies are really helping. When I say new technologies, I just mean satellite technologies are helping them in ways that are sort of irreplaceable.
Do you put a dollar value on satellite assistance, say, to commercial fishing or to agriculture?
I don't. I think I thought the NIST, this was a Department of Commerce report from 2019, and they were just focused on GPS. I think their number was something like just the value to the U.S. The U.S. private economy has been something like $14 trillion from GPS. So that was we leveraged those numbers, but I didn't assign valuations. We leveraged this. I think that report said that if there was a disruption to GPS, just to GPS. And again, our report is thinking beyond GPS to other satellites, remote sensing satellites, communication satellites. There would be, and if it were in the spring season, if there were a disruption to GPS, just in the agriculture section, just in the agriculture sector, there would be losses of $1 billion per day.
Wow.
So, you know, I think that was pretty striking. And again, that's, you know, not considering these other satellite systems that are also really valuable for that culture sector.
You have a caller waiting on hold. Hi, caller. Welcome to our program today. Who are you and where are you, please?
Hi, this is John in Fremont, California.
Hi, John. Welcome to the program again.
Hi. You were talking about the wildfires, and I'm just wondering, can satellite imagery be used in forest management to, locate where they need to do controlled burns or where they need to, clear out underbrush and that sort of thing?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think it depends on the resolution. I think satellites are going to be really good at identifying sort of macro trends. You might want drones in areas where you want a bit more resolution. So, you know, we can use probably, you know, especially these commercial capabilities that are in low Earth orbit are going to be really valuable for this sort of thing. But, you know, it's probably some combination of that and some airborne systems that can be at lower altitude. But, yeah, absolutely, that's part of the equation.
Yeah, I would imagine that the indirect value of that sort of data would be quite significant.
Hey, John, can we use a satellite somehow to compel the politicians to do forest management, like maybe zing them with an electrical jolt if they don't do it or something like that?
Well, you know, it sounds like, that might be an option. I don't know.
If you own an Napa winery, I'll bet you're wishing for that technology right now today, so...
Yeah, I'm just wondering if it exists and if, I mean, a lot of people are hurting now because of these fires. So I would hope someone's looking into this because, we need to mitigate this problem. What about, an EMP pulse? I don't know why I thought about this, but, you know, of all the services that we depend on, if it gets knocked out, I mean, that would be really significant. Are people doing war games like, you know, looking into that?
Sorry, if there was an EMP attack, how would we be able to, how would we respond? Is that your question?
Well, I don't know. I mean, we're talking about all these services that we depend on space, and then if they just go away, I mean, it's something that somebody needs to be thinking about, I would hope.
No. That's absolutely true. And that's part of what we're trying to think about, too, as far as this project, in thinking, you know, what are terrestrial backups? You know, what are other ways that we could achieve these systems? I think if there is, I would say if there's a disruption to GPS, there's some sort of immediate backups. In terms of other satellite, other global navigation satellite systems that we could use, but if there was disruption to all space systems, then the problem becomes harder, and then you start thinking about terrestrial systems. So I think that's something that I do believe needs more research and more thought. But you're absolutely right. We are in every sector. We are heavily reliant on satellite systems. It's a big part of the support that enables so many of the activities and applications that we do today.
Yeah, well, thank you. This is a good show. I'll sign off and see if someone else wants to.
Thank you, John. Listeners,
yes,
you can reach us. Our toll-free number is 866-687-7223. You know, Sam, I mean, it's probably not part of your report, but I remember 2 or 3 years ago there were a lot of Navy ships having collisions, and most of them seemed to be in the Pacific for some reason, and some of them resulted in loss of life. And what the Navy decided to do was to reinstigate learning how to do celestial navigation, because they found that even their command officers on the decks of ships didn't know how to do it. It was just a lost talent, and if any of their instrumentation was offline, you know, or their GPS was not calibrated correctly or something, these guys were screwing up their navigation big time. So the backup was to start training officers again and the necessary people in that situation in celestial navigation. You know, because they gave away all those trade school, you know, terrestrial talents, thinking you'll never need them anymore. And then all of a sudden they found that they sure as hell could use them.
That's absolutely true. I mean, it is. I mean, you know, GPS is, you know, just as a more relatable example. I mean, you know, I just moved to a neighborhood. I'm also in California. I'm in Orange County right now, and you know, I've lived here now long enough where I shouldn't need GPS to figure out where I'm. You know, where that third market is that I like to go to. But, you know, I drive so infrequently, and because I've used GPS every time to get to that third market, I still use it, right? Like, but if this was 20 years ago, you know, I would have just learned how to get there. So, I mean, yeah, is it learning, using a map, you know, celestial navigation, and there are some companies that are focused on alternatives to GPS in denied environments. And so, you know, that's becoming a growing industry. And there was the Department of Homeland Security has focused on trying to think about, you know, what a resilient position navigation timing system looks like for the United States. And that includes thinking about backups to GPS. So there is a lot of focus on this area. But, you know, I'd say our report shows that there is there is just a ton of value and necessity that comes with the space systems that we have, and so, you know, while these backups are important, they're not going to do everything that these satellite systems do, and we should really try to take those for granted and make sure that we're protecting them.
I've been in California for 50 years, and I can't go anyplace without GPS. It tells me the traffic. It tells me if I have to detour.
Right.
If I have to be at an appointment at 9 o'clock in the morning, it tells me if I'm going to leave at 7 a.m. or at 8:15 a.m. I'd be lost if GPS went out. It's not that I don't know the way to get there. It's that there's so many variables now between here and where I'm going that GPS reports all of them. It's a phenomenal service. You have another caller. Hi, caller. Welcome to our program today. Who are you and where are you?
This is Marshall. I was enjoying the show earlier, and you were talking about GPS and the little fishing boats.
Right.
And also in the combines and tractors and so on.
Uh-huh.
And one of the things that I think needs to be brought out is, gee, how much computer power is actually used in doing the GPS? How much silicon does it take? You know, the computer that's helping you drive the boat or the tractor or so on, how much of it's actually doing GPS for you?
Well, tell us, or maybe our guest knows. I don't know.
I have been studying the new Apple processor, the A14, and the chip itself is about 100 square millimeters.
Okay.
That's about the size of your little fingernail.
Okay.
And only about 1/1000th of that chip is dedicated to processing GPS data.
Wow.
Yeah. One of the reasons the GPS seems to be in everything is it only costs you $1, maybe $2 to add it. So, you know, it gets tossed in. And like you're saying, once you learn how to do things with the GPS and the computer and so on like that, it's hard to give it up.
Yes, we're addicted, that's for sure.
Mm-hmm. And another thing is, even if you get denied GPS service, a lot of computers have ring laser gyros, which will basically, for a couple of hours, provide you with continuous capacity to judge how you're moving around in 3D space. It's used in aircraft. And they're good for, you know, 4 or 5 hours. And they're plenty accurate enough. I mean, let's face it, after 15 minutes, you might be a couple hundred yards off of where GPS would be. GPS is obviously better. But, you know, like you go through the, all I can think of is the Holland Tunnel or the Eisenhower Tunnel. But, you know, the traffic tunnels that you drive in?
Uh-huh.
Your computer systems basically go, oh, okay, I got lost signal, but I got my internal navigation and I can, you know, float through and keep it accurate while it's temporarily out. So, yeah, it's even more important because everybody's going to be relying on it more and more and more.
Marshall, do you think that people who rely on it more and more have a clue that it's coming from space and it's a space resource?
No, I think they basically think it comes from their radio. You know, like if you ask somebody, what's the name of that, the radio, satellite radio?
Sirius XM.
Yeah, yeah. You know, you ask them, where does that station come from? And they go, the radio. They don't think about space or anything else behind it. They might be able to tell you something about the personalities that are on the station, but, you know, they don't think of the technology at all. And the technology is very important if you're going to have progress, but a lot of people just don't have any mental capacity to comprehend the progress.
Sam, I have a GPS indicator on my dog collar because I have a husky,
yeah.
and if she gets off the leash somehow or the leash fails, I need to find her. So, first of all, it's made by Whistle. I'm not trying to give them any kind of a commercial introduction. They don't sponsor the show or anything, so to hell with that. But if you look at their marketing data and what they do to sell their GPS for dogs and cats, it doesn't have anything to do with space. They don't show you satellites, how many satellites they're triangulating on. Nothing. I mean, it's all, you know, find your beloved dog, and here's, you can do it with your cell phone and all that. But here's the thing. It was broadcasting up until a couple of months ago on 3G. So my signal in Petaluma in Sonoma County is pretty crappy. So I would call, and of course the technicians I would talk to also don't know anything about space. So I would say, you know, why are you using 3G? Do you have another model that's at least on 4G and all that? And so they'd say it uses so little power and so little bandwidth that there's absolutely no reason whatsoever to have this GPS working on anything more than 3G. Well, as the cell phone companies are pushing to go 5G, they've dumped their 3G service, or they're in the process of doing it. So I had to upgrade the damn device to one that works on 4G. But again, if you go to their paraphernalia and you talk about consumer awareness, there's nothing about space. And if you don't know how GPS works or even rudimentary how it works, the fact that your dog is being tracked by a satellite is not part of your knowledge base.
Yeah, it's tracking the dog by collar. It's nothing to do with space. It's the collar.
Absolutely. I mean, and 3G, which doesn't, you're talking about how much it uses on a new Mac chip. This is using hardly any power if it's tracking on 3G.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But
all the fun I have for the moment.
Okay, but you don't measure the value of all of this to people like me, in that are consumers of these products, and I do recognize they're coming from space. I have no way to really provide feedback into these reports that try to look at the commercial value of space. The consumers like me, and there are others like me, I'm not the only one, we're kind of not tabulated in the statistics.
Yeah. David, because I just wanted to clarify, too, we started talking about, you were asking about the IEA report,
uh-huh.
and these differing accounts of the space economy, but, the space economy is different than value, right?
Right.
The space economy is not accounting for the value from GPS, because GPS is a free service from the U.S. government, right? I mean, it's free to us because of the U.S. government. And same thing with the weather satellite data that we get. Now there are some private companies, but, largely we're getting data from U.S. government satellites, right? So, this isn't the space economy is not accounting for just the value and services that we're getting on the ground from systems that are publicly owned. So, the value is different, right? I mean, I talked about for agriculture, if we were to just lose GPS during the spring season, you'd have perhaps losses in terms of 1 billion per day. So the value is really striking, and that's way bigger than what the space economy is.
I guess another way of saying the value would be the importance. Would that almost
right.
be a synonym?
Right. Yeah. Absolutely. And I mean, I think we talked about we debated about what the right title of the report should be. The value does sort of evoke this sort of quantitative sense of, we're going to have a number at the end. But, we really just wanted to tell the story, right? Just tell the story of how space is so critical. We're talking about wildfires. We have a section about emergency response, it's not just the detection of like a wildfire, but it's everything from, communication satellites being used to disseminate warnings to people, GPS responders being able to, responders being able to use GPS to use the exact, get there the most precise way, remote sensing satellites to be able to see if there's damage, if there needs to be, if roads are even the right way to do this, should we be using helicopters or something else, right? I mean, in the power grid, GPS is used, and weather satellites are really integral to determining, how power grid operators should synchronize energy. Is there going to be a hurricane? Is there going to be a tornado? Is there going to be a lightning storm that's going to require me to turn on or off generators, right? Like, there's just such a spectrum of applications and services that we aren't even thinking about that space is enabling. And we just wanted to try to tell some of that in this report.
You have another caller wanting to talk to you. Hello, caller. Who are you and where are you, please? Thank you for calling.
Hi, this is Doug from Redlands.
Hi, Doug.
Sam, I wanted to ask about, David, are we getting an echo?
No, I'm not getting an echo, but I don't know about
okay.
you. I'm not
yeah,
getting one.
A small one. So, Sam, I'm just wondering about future demand that doesn't exist now, or you cannot directly extrapolate from the markets that we have now. In particular, The value of space in terms of countries wanting to go and see their national astronauts exploring the moon on behalf of their own citizens. So there could be, from those national budgets, a significant amount of purchasing of seats to go to the moon and to Mars, for that matter. And then likewise, basically Elon's case for, you know, business case, is that people who would like to go ahead and move to Mars, that they would go ahead and sell their homes and use that money saved up from markets on Earth at other times, and then applying that towards the transportation to Mars and living on Mars. And I would say the same thing would apply to the moon. Do you get into, you know, the future value of markets that don't yet exist yet?
Yeah, you know, we stay pretty close to the ground for this report. So, you know, we're really thinking about, you know, what you're talking about is this really emerging, burgeoning area that people are really excited about for future value. I mean, especially when you're thinking about like asteroid mining, but all of that is still, is not yet happening right now, right? So we actually recently had a report. So my center, which is kind of the policy shop, the Center for Space Policy and Strategy, the policy shop for the Aerospace Corporation, which is our, like, the U.S. federally funded research development center dedicated to space, just had a report out by Jim Vetta, who's been on this program, about cislunar activity and what, like, you know, what are some of the big issues for a cislunar economy, for example, and that touches on that a little bit more. We do talk a little bit about how some of these capabilities, current capabilities, could be used in ways for these sectors that are not being heavily used right now. So, for example, in agriculture, since we've talked about that a bit, you know, you have this really great data, you know, per field, from farmers about, you know, what the health of their crops is in certain situations. You know, they have all this data that, you know, from remote sensing, overhead imagery to geo-referenced combines, but that data is not really being aggregated in any way. And you could imagine if you have so much data now about what some of these farming trends are. If you were able to kind of combine all of this and use it at a macro level, it could be really informative to kind of figure out what are the best circumstances for these crops, at a macro statistical perspective. You know, we're now getting, you know, we have so much, you know, what are the right elevations for certain crops, based on what we're getting from individual farms. So there's this, you know, data analysis bit that, I think in the future, this could be really informative to developing countries. They may, you know, want some of this data, but it's just not being manipulated right now in a way that makes that that would make that type of consultation really informative, because it's still just being done at a per farm, basis.
Okay,
Did that help?
Yeah. You know, I also think of things like that are really on the near term, like the Starlink constellation, and serving people who don't have internet access in rural areas. That seems like a near term, you know, growth into sort of new market economy.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, Starlink, the being able to have, you know, the communication satellites of that magnitude are something we've never seen, right? So, I think they've proposed that SpaceX has proposed something like 40,000 satellites for Starlink constellation. So that would be, and right now, you know, there's about 3,000 active satellites in orbit, for comparison. So, you know, the satellite environment is going to continue to change. We're going to, you know, as the satellite environment, changes, we're going to be extracting more value here down on Earth.
Doug,
No, that's all. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much, Doug.
Excuse me.
Listeners, that line is free, and we still have time if you would like to give us a call. 866-687-7223. I noticed that you have in your report, we haven't really talked about it, but a lot of national security and banking and financing. Now, of course, that benefits all of us, whether, again, we have an awareness of it or not. But you're mostly business to business, from what I can gather. So how these services affect the industry that uses them, not necessarily how they affect who they deliver it to. So it's business to business, correct?
Yeah, I mean, in the finance section, you know, it's everything from, you know, if you have a bank application on your phone, to using ATMs, right? This is using communication satellites to then if you're thinking about trading firms and regulators, you know, you have this timing function on GPS that allows you to record financial transactions in terms of nanoseconds. So if there was, you know, which is really important when you're thinking about, you know, the stock market and you how, you know, fluctuations in a couple seconds can be hugely consequential, right, in terms of valuation. So, you know, the timing function of GPS, which is not a function that is usually talked about with respect to GPS, but the timing function is really critical for recording financial transactions. Because then, and if there was something that was, you know, on the other side, right, on the regulator side, if there was something that seemed nefarious, you have these, you know, these nanosecond time stamps financial transactions that you can then go and do sort of an autopsy of and sort of discover, you know, what the sequence was to make sure that everything was done correctly. So, you know, the GPS timing function is really critical for the stock market, as well as, you know, the communication satellites are really integral for just how you and I use our phones, use our banks, use ATMs. It's helpful sort of at the macro level and at the micro level. And you know, this timing function for financial markets is also really important for the power grid too. Because, you know, you also want to have high precision when you are, when you're monitoring the power grid and making decisions of, you know, increasing voltage here, turning on generators here, turning off generators there, and that's done at really high precision for timing because of GPS.
I have a caller on hold, but I also have an email from Sarah, and Sarah's in Vancouver listening to the program, and she said, if we woke up in the morning and space was 100% gone, evaporated, we had zero technologies, zero anything with it, would we be at a 1950s level of development and economy, or might we be even more primitive than the 1950s?
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, I don't want to be too alarmist. I do think that there are some backups available. I don't think we would revert back 70 years, but it would obviously be pretty chaotic. I mean, I don't know. I mean, it would almost be, you know, it would almost be scarier, whatever the cause of that was, than the effect in some ways, right? Because does that mean that we're in sort of a world war? I mean, is it just that, like, a space weather event that was so catastrophic that it nullified all space capabilities? There would be, you know, the cause in that scenario is pretty concerning to me, not just the effect. The effect would be obviously really serious, but I don't know if it would knock us back 7 years.
Maybe the universe wants to teach us a lesson, so this is right. This is a lesson from the universe, and the universe did this to us. So
yeah.
So you don't think we'd go back to?
I don't know. I really that's a hard question. I mean, it's obviously we've had a lot of other capabilities that have matured alongside satellite systems over the last 70 years, but you have, you know, how integral satellite systems are into all technologies, there would be certainly a disruption.
There's
going to be a bad disruption at that point, but I don't know what, you know, I think over time we would be able to stabilize. I don't know if we would be able to deal with whatever the cause was of whatever eliminated all space. That's
it'd probably make our toilet paper shortages early in the COVID thing look like a cakewalk compared to what we've gone through shortages if space disappeared.
That's right.
You have another caller on hold. Hi, caller. Welcome to our program today. Who are you and where are you? And we thank you for calling.
This is John of Fort Worth. It's kind of ironic what you moved into just before I called. Because I was going to mention the fact that certainly in the military and sort of like, for instance, aircraft, the day our systems are so set up relying on the GPS for accuracy, for instance, that they've basically, you know, scaled back the payloads of a lot of things in a lot of ways. And so, you know, these GPS-guided bombs, as JDAMs, are incredibly accurate, but they require a GPS signal to guide them to the target. And if they didn't have that, I don't know how well the people are trained to do the old style dumb bombing like they did back in the, you know, Vietnam era and that period where you actually had to, you know,
talk about celestial navigation. I bet there's not a one of them that could work a Norton bomb site from World War II.
Yeah, or just the stuff they had in the 60s. But I mean, nobody is. I mean, you know, you're counting on just set the coordinates and release the thing, and it goes to the target, you know, and the only thing that goes wrong is if the coordinates are wrong or the thing malfunctions. Other than that, something's blown up, you know, but in the old days you had to kind of aim and drop a whole bunch of bombs, and you have a certain probability each of them would hit, and they'd pattern all over the place, and you hope one of them actually destroyed the target, you know. And that's not the, you know, they're not really used to that now, and you got your... You know, F-35, for instance, typically carries two bombs internally, you know. You know, that's, other than going external and losing your signature reduction, you're pretty much, you know, as they call it, the beast mode or whatever, you can do that, you know, but how well are people trained to do that anymore, you know, to deliver those things accurately, you know?
Yeah, it's a good question. I can't say, but yeah, obviously GPS is a huge part of precision strike. I mean, that's, you couldn't do precision strike, I think, without GPS. So that is, yeah, I mean, it's, you know, we haven't talked about the national security functions, but of course GPS was initially a DOD program, right? So, you know, this was thinking about precision strike, thinking about maneuvering of forces, and it, you know, still has all that, that value and those applications, but now that it's been opened up to the rest of the world, it's provided just the U.S. a ton of value, and that's why you've seen other countries, you know, emulate GPS. You have Russia developed its own global navigation satellite system, GLONASS. China developed its global navigation system, Beidou. You had Galileo now coming online, the European Union global navigation satellite system, and then you have some regional systems in terms of Japan's QZSS and India's 7 satellite system. So, you know, there's the GPS has been such a good capability that you've seen a lot of people try to imitate it.
Yeah, it's being used a lot for everything. I mean, even just basic land navigation for ground forces probably relies on it today a lot, you know.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. And then if you're thinking about, you know, a big part of, for military services, logistics, right? And so just the, you know, the transport of supplies, GPS is integral to that.
Yeah. One of the big things, like that previous question, I think, is just the fact that if you were to lose it all of a sudden in a hypothetical world, you're all set up to use it. and all of a sudden what you're used to, like, well, suppose I lost all electronic calculators. Gee, do I even have a slide rule now? I mean, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
No. I haven't used one of those in years, you know?
Yeah.
Well, you have your fingers. You can count on your fingers, John.
Yeah, I guess. But I'm just saying, I'm just going to illustrate the kind of disruption, what you're used to going away is a different thing than you know, not having it in the first place and being used to the old system. I mean, we did great things with slide rules and log tables in the old days before my time, of course. But I'm saying people just today aren't used to that. You know, they're not trained for
right.
it. And, yeah. Oh, well, I'll leave it at that. I just thought that was an interesting point to make.
Thank you.
No, that was great.
Thank you, John.
Okay.
Listeners, John is off. If you want to call us, we still have time. 866-687-7223. Does your report get into, or maybe it's in another aerospace industry report, recommendations for emergencies, for backups, for what to do if all of a sudden agriculture is blind or banking and finance is blind or national security is largely blind? Do you get into alternative solutions or protective measures or defensive postures or anything like that?
Yeah, it's a great question, David. You know, our report is more descriptive and really just kind of laying out, you know, these different stories of how space systems are so important. But, you know, we don't get into normative discussions of what we should do or what we should invest in. However, that is something that we're working on right now. So it's possible that sometime in 2021 we would be issuing something, thinking more about what are some of the what are the policy options given the availability of backups to space systems, given the importance of space systems to so many of our critical infrastructures.
Here's an interesting one. Lonnie is in Chicago and says, I downloaded the report when your other guest was on the show from the aerospace, and I still have it, so I've been refreshing my memory about it. One of the things that sticks out to me is we have started a space force, and I know it's in its very primitive early stages. But it seems to me that space is going to be the domain that is key to almost every country and every industrialized economic country on the planet today, and that since we do have nefarious actors along with natural things that happen, being able to protect space and what we put up there that influences our daily life, whether we're aware of it or not, seems to be very key to me. So all of a sudden, the Space Force, in the context of this report and others, becomes of great significance and great importance. I'm wondering how you see the role of the new Space Force, and is it up to the job of protecting what we now know is so valuable to our way of life?
Yeah, I mean, I would first just say I think that, you know, I do think that there was a growing recognition in the importance of space, also comes with a sort of, you know, an associated, an importance and a belief in the need to defend, what exists in space. I mean, I do think that it's something that gets lost in the Space Force discussion is that, you know, space has always been a military domain. I mean, it's been, you know, we've had military satellites in space for a long time, and Space Force is, you know, assuming a lot of the responsibilities that Air Force Space Command, and that, you know, that STRATCOM, you know, with SpaceCom coming online, that STRATCOM used to carry out. So, you know, a lot of this is taking responsibilities that was in the military elsewhere and kind of trying to consolidate them in a space force. But you know, the importance of the domain, I think, has been recognized by government for a really long time. I think in some ways the Space Force public discussion has kind of made the importance of space, has brought up this discussion of the importance of space to other people. But I think people within the community, obviously you've been an institution in this community for a really long time, have seen the importance of space. And I will just, one part of the question was noting that, in for the future that countries are going to be continuing to focus on space. I mean, one, on a different project that I worked on at Aerospace Corporation, we were tracking kind of 180 countries, in the world, what their future space investments could be. And there's a pretty good parallel between the richest countries in the world and the countries that have the most space investment. So, it seems, countries that once they have enough money, they want to start getting involved in space, seems pretty clear. So, it's definitely I think, an integral part of what countries' budgets are, and I think that's going to continue in the future.
Interesting. I think the Space Force debate, to the degree people paid attention to it in the public, has helped focus on how valuable space is. At least I hope so. George is in Atlanta with another email question, and he says, do you see the rise of the new type of commercial space businesses, the entrepreneurials, the startups? Some are in satellite, some are in launch industry, and others. Are they an asset to the value and importance of space, or is it neutral with what they're doing, or could it possibly work to the detriment of the importance of space?
Yeah, I mean it's a great question. It's a difficult question. It's a great question. Obviously a lot of the new capabilities, new companies that are proposing some pretty astounding stuff from space are from billionaires, right? So, it's this weird thing where, it's really reliant on numbers of people, so many of these new companies. So, that lends itself to like, well, what if, is this a little capricious, right? Could some of these folks change their mind? Could they decide to invest elsewhere, right? That is what's a little alarming about how, in some ways, personality driven, some of these capabilities are, that it's really like, well, this company is Jeff Bezos, or this is Elon Musk, or this is the company that Bill Gates was investing in, right? And so you really don't know, how much endurance there is to some of the emergence of all these companies, but obviously, I think at this point there's we've seen just a lot of good so far. I mean, you've seen a lot of good from you have these rockets these rockets that can then be relaunched. I mean, that saves so much money in terms of launch. So there's really impressive innovations that have come from this private investment in space, but it's hard to predict what that private investment in space is going to look like in the future, because it isn't like other industries. It isn't like how other industries have developed, right? It's unclear what profit looks like to a lot of these people. It seems as if maybe this is more of an area of interest to explore for something else than maybe just as like a clear profit generating mechanism. So it's a difficult question what the future of the private space economy looks like, but I would say on the whole, we've seen some really cool innovations that have come from the private investments we've had so far.
Is competition in this industry, is it a stabilizing effect? Is it good? I mean, generally we think competition is good for growth and innovation. Or is it maybe destabilizing because of the immense importance, the national security value, and these other intrinsic values that we've been talking about for the past 90 minutes. So how do you see competition?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's, you know, I think there's competition in terms of in the private sector, that, you know, you've seen innovations come from some of these, from some of the competition. You know, I'd say at the international sector, you know, and there's, you know, some of this competition could be seen as concerning, right? Because a lot of the, you know, countries are emulating capabilities that we have, and some countries that, you know, that we're concerned about what their intentions are, vis-a-vis kind of the strategic relationship with the United States. So, you know, I would say it's a mixed bag. I'd say, you know, again, the, you know, the U.S. public space investments have really been integral to everything that we've seen, though. So even though you're seeing this, you know, more private sector interest and these commercial capabilities, you know, a lot of this has been, you know, built on public sector investments and technologies that we've invested in for a long time.
I know we're getting close to the end of a 90-minute show, but if you put on your futuristic eyeglasses and started gazing into the future, is the value of space as you described it in your report, and so not a dollar value, but the value of space based on importance, is it going to continue to increase in 5 years and over 10 years? Is it going to reach a point where it's as valuable as it's ever going to be? Or is it going to probably be like commodity prices? Like right now, gold and silver are extremely high, but maybe if things were to somehow stabilize and calm down, gold and silver might drop a whole bunch. So is the value of space subject to commodity pricing? I guess that's what I'm trying to ask you.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I would say in terms of some of the technologies that we see coming online, and that, you know, space is going to become more important to us on the ground. You know, so I think as long as the space remains a domain that is usable, that is hospitable, that, you know, we can, is an area ripe for scientific exploration and you know, a way to exploit new technologies, that we're going to see increased value from space systems 5 years from now, 10 years from now. I think it's going to continue to grow.
We are coming up close to 90 minutes. Have we left anything out? Have we not covered something in the report that you think we should have covered?
No, I would just say, you know, I hope folks enjoy the report. You know, it's the Center for Space Policy and Strategy. This is our policy shop. A lot of our stuff is a little bit more focused on space systems in this report. So this report, we really wanted it to be accessible to sort of a broad audience of people who are interested in space. And then, you know, I think this could be a good way, a good appetizer to other reports that we've issued that are focused on specific space issues, whether it's spectrum, whether it's cislunar orbit, whether it's the missile environment, whether it's specific countries like Japan's satellite capabilities, whether it's Canada's, whether it's Luxembourg's. So we have, you know, there's a lot of good reports that we have. So I hope people enjoy this one and use it as a way to look at some of our other reports. And David, are we going to put the report in the show notes, or is there an easy way for folks to access this?
I'll put the URL for the report both in the summary of the show, and I'll also post it on the blog.
Great.
People can access it. If anybody beats me to it, and you post it on the blog before I do, that's fine. But I will definitely put it in the summary. And by the way, it's listed also in the show with Michael Gleason from a couple of months ago, so it's there too.
That's right. That's right.
What are you working on next? Do you have another great project that you're doing?
Yeah, so I had a Japan paper come out earlier this summer, and then a missile project that was a space launch vehicle and a missile are both rockets. So missiles are also part of our focus here at Aerospace. So I had a project looking at the emerging missile environment that came out last month, and working on a different missile project right now that's on the hypersonic missile debate. So the debate within the United States about hypersonic missiles. In terms of more space-focused pieces, doing a project on South Korea, and then some other pieces about space-based intercepts, their role. So a lot of security-focused projects over the course of the year, with the exception of the South Korea one.
When will your hypersonic paper make it to publication?
I'm thinking that that's going to be late November, early December.
We follow hypersonic development on the show. It's a big topic. So when it's published, if you remember to let me know, I'd love to get you back on the show to talk about it.
Yeah, absolutely. I will definitely let you know. Yeah.
Okay. Michael, listen to me. Sam, I want to thank you very much for taking us through the paper and this discussion. I know we had some offbeat comments and questions, but sometimes that makes it a lot more interesting.
No, it's great.
And we certainly look forward to talking to you again down the road. And I will send you the email with the program archived and the summary in it, so you'll get that sometime tomorrow. And I appreciate it, and thank you very much for being here. And it's good to talk to you, and looking forward to more space shows with you as you do more of these great reports.
Great. Thanks so much. It's really a pleasure to speak with you. And, again, I've always been a fan of the show, so this was a real honor for me.
Thank you. And listeners, remember we have a special show tomorrow evening, and then the rest of the week is as planned and normal. So everyone have a great rest of the week. Please keep it safe. Goodbye from Sam, David, and the Space Show. And as you keep looking up, do it at night and go see what Mars looks like as it comes very, very close to the United States and the rest of Earth, and you're not going to see it this close for 15 years or so take advantage of it. Once again, goodbye from the space show.